This is the year to stop overpaying for your family plan. So choose a Straight Talk wireless family plan. Unlimited data, talk, and text on a reliable 5G network. And you can get a new line starting at $25 per line per month for 4 lines, plus taxes and fees and no contracts. That's good decision making. Available at Walmart and on straighttalk.com. Family plan discount with 4 lines, all on the Silver Unlimited plan. Not combinable with auto pay discount. In times of traffic, your data may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Video streams at up to 480p. Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson, you know, before they were legends of outlaw country, they were lost souls looking for their sound. Don't miss Mandy Moore and the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the rise of outlaw country music and its biggest stars. Hear how one woman's vision in her tiny living room, far from Nashville's Music Row, became the epicenter of a musical movement. Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in The Boar's Nest. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest. Hey, it's Bobby Bones. Hey, I just want to say thanks to everybody who has stepped up for the St. Jude kids. St. Jude's doing incredible work fighting childhood cancer. And because of donations like the ones that you give, families never receive a bill ever from St. Jude for treatment, travel, housing, food, none of that. Help St. Jude stop childhood cancer. Become a partner in hope. Get this awesome new This Shirt Saves Lives shirt. It's going to look great on you. So join all the doctors, researchers, and me in this fight. All right, text the word Bobby. It's only 6 numbers to 785-833. Again, text the word Bobby to just these 6 numbers, 785-833.
Hello and welcome to part one of the top 8 Bobbycast in 2021. I am your host for this episode. I am Mike D, producer of the Bobbycast, and we have selected the best interviews that we did this year. Bobby and I came up with a list of our favorites. We took a look at the most downloaded episodes of the year, and we also asked you on Twitter and Instagram what you thought were the best episodes. Took all that and made 2 special episodes that we're going to share with you this week and next week. If you don't follow us online, we are at the Bobbycast on Twitter and Instagram. So I'll be your host this week and next week. We took clips of the best 8 interviews from the entire year, and I'll give you some behind the scenes from some of these interviews. As a producer, my job is to book the guests, research the guests, pull up all the audio clips you hear within these episodes, and then I'm in the room with Bobby while we do these interviews. So I'll give you a look into that process behind each of these interviews. And if you're not subscribed to the Bobbycast, wherever you're listening to this right now, hit that follow button, hit that subscribe button to be sure you get brand new episodes starting in 2022. And if you're looking for something completely different to listen to, I also do a podcast of my own called Movie Mike's Movie Podcast. If you're looking for movie recommendations, I do spoiler-free movie reviews, and I also interview actors and directors and talk all things movies every single week. So that's another podcast I hope you check out. But here we go. Let's get into the top 8 Bobbycast interviews of 2021. We'll start right now with number 8 with Ashley McBride. Now, this was the first time Bobby and I had ever met Ashley McBride, and you actually hear it in this full interview. The moment she walks into the room is the first time we ever met her, so I thought that was kind of a cool moment to capture. And another part of my job as the producer on this show, I coordinate with them getting over to Bobby's house, and then I go meet them out front. And this is only hard for me because I am terrible at small talk, so I kind of have this routine in my head that I go through with each guest, so I have things to say as we walk all the way back to the studio. So here we go with number 8.
Come on in, guys. Hey, Ashley.
I'm going to put this monster in some airplane mode. Mom loves to call when I'm doing something.
It's like an innate sense that she should call you right when something's
absolutely
happening. Yeah.
I wonder what Ashley's doing. Like,
how often do you talk to your mom?
Not quite as often right now, but it's usually, I don't know, every couple days.
Oh, really?
Yeah, or anytime I try to cook something.
And is that often? And
yeah,
are you a good cook?
I'm not bad.
I think what I'm really interested in is people who do something really wonderfully, like you as an artist, songwriter. But also, what else are you good at? And does that translate, like, your drive for being an artist into anything else in your life? That same drive.
That I think that drive pops up in handiwork.
Really?
Yeah, I like to fix stuff myself. And when it's too much for me to tackle, I'm not afraid at all to call in for the rescue party. But like, I had a problem with my air duct, my brand new house. It just kept flooding. The downstairs kept flooding, and then that finally results in an air duct getting full of water. And I was like, I can fix that.
So did you go, because what we have now is the ability to go to YouTube for anything.
Yeah.
Which changes,
you know,
the game.
Before I went to YouTube though, I called, so my drummer is also a mechanic and an Eagle Scout and he's awesome. I did not call him. I called his father. who taught that boy how to be all of those things. So I called George Hill and I was like, here's what I want to do. And he was like, okay, here are the steps you need to make sure you take. So I did it.
It's also funny, too, that when you're in an artistic business, like you are in my different worlds that I'm in, you're broke a long time.
Yeah.
And you have to figure out how to do other things, because since you're so broke, you have to learn or you just die.
Right.
Because you can't do music, or I can't, you know, try to do radio or be a comedian, because there's no money in it for the first forever.
No, forever.
So you have to fix your own crap and cook your own meals.
That's
and learn to survive.
And you become a good cook because you get tired of eating crappy food.
And you kind of acquire all of these skills.
Yeah.
And then you get it kind of all figured out at once, and you think you have it figured out, then you realize you have no idea and you kind of start over again.
Yeah. But I think it just has to do with your ability to be miserable and your tolerance for it.
Agree. I mean, I know you're kind of joking, but it was about going, well, this is uncomfortable, but it's always been uncomfortable for me.
Yeah.
You know, growing up, you know, a poverty kid. And I was like, what's the worst that can happen? I stay the same? Like,
right.
So let's go.
My vacuum broke 2 days ago. Just like the little spinny thing stopped being a spinny thing. And I thought, well, I can probably get someone to fix it. I can probably just buy another one. But what I'm going to do now is take it apart entirely.
You really did that?
And fix it myself. Because, you know, before I lived back here, back in Nashville, I was over in Watertown. There was nobody around to help. And growing up, we didn't have a lot of money. And when something broke, my mother would fix it. My father would fix it. He can fix anything. But my mom's not afraid to take something apart and see how it works either. So,
do you feel like a little bit of you does that because you feel like that's where you come from? Because, I mean, at this point, you have plenty of money.
I can get another vacuum. Yeah.
Right, right. And I struggle with this too sometimes.
Yep.
Like, you could get a vacuum. You could hire somebody to get a vacuum, bring it to you, and vacuum your floor.
Oh,
you could
yeah.
You could.
I didn't think about having someone else clean my house. That'd be great.
And that's but a bit of that, I wonder if that is that instilled in you, and that's what you just do because of where you come from and the people that raised you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think our first instinct for people like you and I is to roll up our sleeves and figure it out for ourselves. And that's cooking or fixing a vacuum cleaner, or how do I make a career making stuff up and expect to be paid for it?
And that's where it comes back over to.
Yeah.
I mean, that's it. You had to go. I mean, listen, you played these small biker bars, you know.
Yeah. You've been to Cabot, Arkansas.
Many times. I mean, I know everywhere that your story has gone, from Jonesboro to Arkansas State,
yep,
to that's my path as well, you know, one way or the other.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when I would know your story, but then I would kind of reread your story to make sure that I was still kind of clued in. Before I do this, I kind of go back over things. And it's just like, dang, like, that's a different way to go about it as someone who wants to be known as a great songwriter and country music artist and a female.
Right.
To go into these bars. But there's no other way. That's
my
point.
I thought that's how it was
done. That's just how, right.
No one told me. Just like, you know, I'm left-handed, but I play guitar right-handed. But no one ever told me that was an option. To restring it or turn it upside down or learn it another way. I just thought this was how things were done. So I, you know, would play some shows and like borrow people's equipment to do that, and then save up and buy those pieces of equipment and run my own sound. And, you know, I didn't need like a fog machine or anything, but, you know, how to run monitors and how to ring out a room and all that. And I'm still not a great sound engineer, but I had to figure out how to do it all and how to fund it all.
Talk to me about when you first started playing shows live, like before you learned how to play guitar. We'll get to all that early stuff, but I want to know about your live, kind of your live show experience. Like, was it at a bar or a church, or like, where do you for the first time go and ask for the affection of others you don't know?
I didn't play like a lot of talent shows and stuff. In fact, I was pretty shy. It terrified me. It used to make me cry for people to.
So you mean like in high school?
To pay me any attention.
Right.
Yeah, like middle school. But we lived really close to Hardy, you know, Mammoth Springs, really close to Hardy, Arkansas. And they have canoe rentals and antique shops. And they had a little place in the gazebo where people would play music. And I did that. And they gave me $100 to stand there and play.
Who gave it to you?
I guess like
the city?
The city, yeah. We're just like, go caterwauler out by this gazebo for a couple of hours. And I just played, you know, bluegrass songs and stuff. And so that's probably the first time.
And when you first start playing, do you feel like, I'm pretty good at this? Or do you feel like, this is something I can do while I figure out what I'm good at?
I knew I just wanted to do it. And I didn't know yet at that young age if I was good enough to do it.
How old?
Oh, man. I was probably 12 or 13 when that happened.
Wow.
I started playing guitar when I was 9, but when I was like a little squirt, not any taller than, you know, what do they say, knee high to a grasshopper. We were at a bluegrass festival and I had a plastic Telecaster, got a photo of it. And it had like Mickey Mouse or Kermit the Frog or something on it. And this band called the Tennessee Gentlemen was on stage and they asked my mom, because I'm glued watching these guys, would she like to come and sit on the edge of the stage? So I did. And I didn't take my little plastic guitar at first. And I sat there on the edge of the stage and I watched them play. And then the audience erupted, of course, into applause. And my mom looked at me and she said, I knew you had it. Then you wanted to be on a stage and you wanted people to applaud you.
What kind of music was played around you as a kid?
Luckily, all kinds. I mean, like the Carpenters, Love and Spoonful,
so
John Denver.
60s, 70s vibes. A lot of.
And then also my mom, she didn't try to shove classical music down our throats at all, but she would just kind of have it playing in the house. That we would ask questions. What is this song? And she'd be like, oh, that's Eine kleine Nachtmusik by Mozart. There's a movie about him if you'd like to watch it. And I'm like, oh yeah, I want to watch a movie about this cool guy. So luckily all of that was included. And then my dad, was more like Christofferson, that area. He really liked those tormented songwriters.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, which version of Christofferson?
Yeah, Why Me, Lord, that version. To this day, one of my favorite songs of all time, my favorite Christofferson song is To Beat the Devil.
Is that because of your dad?
Yeah.
Is there a song that was played in your house so much that, let's eliminate that one, but you hear it and it just puts you back, like you feel that, like, dang, I remember being...
Amanda.
Yeah.
Amanda. Because we had this... I think it was supposed to be like a family room, but it's where my dad kept, there was like a gun safe in there and like guitars, and the kids weren't really supposed to be in there a whole bunch, unless you were going to go in there and use an instrument. And so that is just about half a hallway away from the kitchen where my mom is doing dishes. And my dad was playing Amanda on the guitar, singing, and that high part that happens on the end of my mom was singing it in the kitchen. And here I am kind of walking down the hallway and catching both. They're singing together. They don't know. He doesn't know that she's singing with him. And I'm hearing it. And just that song. You see what it does? I'm like,
yeah, no. When I think about Why Not Me from the Judds, because my mom used to sing that. And mom, you know, has since passed away. But it's that you kind of feel how you felt then just for a split second. It's like
there's also the intro to an Alison Krauss record. It was Alison Krauss in Union Station. It's the one. I had it on vinyl. She's seated at like a staircase or something with her fiddle in her hand. And I am 7-ish or 9 years old as soon as I hear that guitar riff start up. And I get giddy.
My therapist at one point gave me a book, and I've been through a decent amount of therapy at this point in my life. And
that's a superpower.
Yeah, it's a tool. It's like Batman has a superpower.
Yes.
Right? Like Batman had a bunch of cool stuff.
Yes.
And so he was a superhero.
That's right.
And so I feel like, again, I've accumulated cool tools and traits and she gave me a book that talked about music, and you know the book talked about how when you hear something, even when you smell something very specific, for a split second in your brain, it reacts the exact same way it did when you were at whatever point. So just for a brief moment, you get that feeling again, like in your chest of like, oh man, that reminds me of being 7 or 9 or 13.
Yeah, because our brains really don't know the difference between an actual experience and the thought of that experience, I suppose. Right?
And our now dumb, you're going Elon Musk. Like, are we I'm even
like,
living?
I'm like, no, what do they call that? Yes. It's like our dumb lizard brain or our caveman brain. They just know that experience is real. So that would make sense.
I was actually studying the three parts of the brain yesterday, which is wild. And, you know, the bottom part of the brain is like the lizard brain. It's they have two modes. They are attacking, running, or relaxing. You know, it's those two.
Right.
They're either, or they're just there's nothing else.
Right.
And I try not to live like that. And I really work on trying... As I've gotten older, I try not to react as much, and I try to respond more.
I'm trying. I'm learning. I love my therapist. And I know it was like probably trying to put overalls on a cat, trying to get me to go to therapy. And finally, it did. And I was like, this is awesome.
Mm-hmm. I was talking yesterday with my therapist, not to go down a whole therapy train, but he was like, when did you know about therapy? I was like, I didn't. I'm from population 772, Arkansas.
Right.
We were trying to afford, you know, a hamburger helper. for dinner. Not you. Yeah. We didn't know about mental health.
It wasn't really an option.
Right.
I mean, everything under the rug is an option. Pray about it is an option, in which that it does work, you know, for a lot of people, that simply praying about it, let go and let God. But also let go and let therapist.
Let go and let, yeah. And for me, it was insurance. I was like, once I even discovered what insurance
let
was.
Let go and let insurance. Yeah, that's even better.
And they were like, he was like, oh, that's how. So yeah, I was like 26. I got insurance for the first time.
Yeah.
So I started going to therapy and talking to somebody who, and I mean this in the best way possible, didn't give a crap about me.
Yeah. That was so freeing.
Because I know that you know you don't have to hang out with me for 3 days and deal with me. You're just going to give me your unbiased advice based on what I'm saying and your education. That's how I feel with them. And so, but yeah, that's been a big tool for me. Do you feel like you've had a whole different set of, like, I don't want to use the word obstacle, but since you've become so popular and famous, like, are you finding new struggles with fame, with notoriety? Because I would assume someone that comes from where you come from, again, like with experience, like, that's just an eye-opening world where you're like, sometimes I love it, but sometimes I really hate it.
Well, yeah, when all you know is struggle, and I have something to prove, but I still feel that way. I still, like, you know, when you rescue a dog that spent its young life really hungry, that dog is always in hunger mode. And so I'm kind of that way. There's some things that I'm struggling with. I mean, I live over in East Nashville where nobody cares, right?
It's a very cool part of town.
It's a very cool part of town. Everybody's super cool about stuff. And just recently, as yesterday, I got stopped a few times, which I think is great. I've worked my whole life for someone to ask for a photo with me. But then I thought, oh, wow, I'm not used to that happening, I don't think. My address got leaked on the internet. That was super cool.
Yeah.
Because I don't live behind a gate,
that sucks.
You know?
Yeah. So it's like as things get better and you feel like a lot of your problem, what I have learned is that problems just pivot. And it's all in how you accept them and realize that everybody's got them.
Yep.
And they've, like, my life has gotten better in a lot of ways. But also, I've had to take on a lot more responsibilities and challenges, and I'm very proud of how I worked. And the same thing, sometimes I'm so tired, but I have to remind myself, I'm so grateful that I get to be tired doing something I love.
Right. I don't know how you have time to be sitting across from me right now with everything you have going on.
Well, the difference is, I don't have a talent. And you say that, I'm a swear to you, I have to hustle as my talent. Like, I have nothing to offer.
Then, hustle is a talent. Hustle is a talent.
I will agree with you there.
But if you weren't talented, you wouldn't live behind a gate. I promise.
True, but there are just some crazy. You're right. I'll let you have that one. I'm not even going to argue that one.
Okay, thank you.
I'll let you have that one.
Thank you.
Your talent. When did you start to be told that you might be great at singing?
I think it started with not being told to not sing when I wasn't great at singing. I was a little kid.
Were you a good little kid singing, or were you a passionate little kid singing?
Both. I was singing Somewhere Out There from An American Tale. And
like Five Wall Goes West?
Oh, yeah.
Somewhere Out There. Wow.
Oh, yeah. And Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And then there was a record. There was a Ricky Skaggs record that I loved. It was like Live in London. And a record by the Whites. I'm hanging around, just a little kid hoping you'll get lonely. And Mom never told me not to sing. There's six of us kids. So there's three boys and then a girl and then another boy and then me. The boy right before me, Daniel, used to throw like shoes and stuff at me and try to get me to shut up. When I'm trying to learn to play mandolin, I'm learning to play guitar, I'm learning to play bass, and I'm singing all the time. And he was the one that was like, shut up. But he's also, he doesn't live far from me at all. And he's one of my biggest champions, my biggest cheerleaders. So my mom was on a bowling league. And like I said, I was a really shy kid, but I didn't mind singing as my way of communicating. So I would sing, I would go up to her friends at the bowling alley and say, do you want to hear me sing something from An American Tale? And they were like, sure. You know, and I'd sing a few things and I'd go get back in my chair and color in my coloring book. So I think not being necessarily told that I was great, but just not being shamed about it from a really young age.
Your dad played music. Your mom loved music.
Yeah.
Did that rub off on any of the other kids to where they...
Yeah. Everybody can sing.
Really?
Everybody can sing.
Wow.
My sister has a beautiful voice. My mother has a beautiful voice. And in church, you know, we were required to know all of the parts, alto, tenor, soprano, bass, everything. My grandmother used to take my finger and move it along the page of the hymnal to show me what notes we were going to be singing. Even if it was the bass, we would sing.
So your grandmother also?
Everybody. Wow. On mom's side and dad's side. Everybody can sing. I'm the only one that just kind of took off with it. I even had one of my brothers played guitar in our younger years, and I don't know why he stopped. I had a brother that played trumpet. My sister played flute. So we are a musical family. I'm just the only one that I guess it kind of stuck.
It's interesting because I'm left-handed and I play guitar left-handed. When I first, I went to a pawn shop and I was doing comedy and I thought, okay, I don't want to have to steal other people's music to do parodies. I want to actually write original comedy stuff. So I went to a pawn shop for $50. I bought a guitar. It was right-handed. And I just switched the strings around. But what happened was there's a nut in it,
yeah,
and it holds different sides. So I kept busting. Right. I was going to say busting nut. I kept breaking these nuts. Yes.
Yeah,
these nuts. The strings kept breaking the nut
right
at the bottom
of
the guitar.
It was bursting it. Yes, it was like, yes, just fracturing it.
Oh, my God.
That's so, okay.
Yes.
I got your back.
So over and over. So it took a long time until I actually got a left-handed guitar. But I did not take to it well. Music for me has been very difficult. I put a lot of work into, you know, learning chords and bar chords. And for me, very difficult. And I can't sing. I can sing just well enough to do comedy that people aren't distracted by my bad singing voice. Now, I'm pretty funny.
You got to give yourself more credit than that.
Trust me.
Okay.
I get enough credit. Don't.
Okay.
Yeah. With you growing up with a family full of music, did you feel like it was kind of intrinsic?
I loved the way it sounded when we all sang in church together. But yeah, it just kind of just is.
Playing guitar.
In me. Love it.
When you started.
Yes.
Still assuming you got bloody fingers.
Yes.
And like everything. But like, do you feel like you got it?
Well, they wouldn't let me play guitar at first because I was too small to hold it safely. So they let me bang on a mandolin. I remember I was probably in kindergarten or first grade going outside to the driveway and rubbing my fingers on the concrete because I thought that would help me get calluses. I was tired of my fingers being sore. And then when I'm 9 years old, my dad takes me to a music store in Thayer, Missouri, which is just right across the line from Mammoth Spring. So up until now, I've been playing mandolin, and then I was big enough that I could sort of play with my mom's Alvarez, but kind of under supervision. But they were going to get me a 3/4 size guitar, and I didn't know. So we went into this music store called Thayer Music, cleverly named, and Dad hands me this little 3/4 size K guitar, and he says, see if you can play something on that. And then he goes and talks to the guy, you know, and I was sitting there playing like Go Tell Aunt Rhody or something. And he walked back in to where I was. He said, can you play it? And I showed him what I figured out. He said, it's time to leave. So I handed the guitar back to the guy behind the counter, and Dad said, nope, that's yours. Mm. Take it home. And so I wasn't great. Mom tells the story that it was like 3 days. My dad shows me like 3 chords when we get home. And about 3 days later, I'm bawling in the kitchen because I can't play and sing at the same time. So I'm learning Snowbird and by Anne Murray, and I'm learning Steel Rails by Alison Krauss in Union Station. And I'm super upset. And Mom said, give it a week. Just give it a week and see if you feel better about it. So I don't know. I think there weren't a lot of distractions growing up on a farm and with access to instruments. I think that helps everything kind of click. There's nothing else to do.
That whole situation of you upset you can't sing and play, that happened to me last week. Same thing. I was like, I can't sing and play. Why can't I do it?
There are still certain things I can't sing and play.
I can't do it. You ever get, it's just wild that you started on the mandolin. I don't hear of many people that, because of their size, just start on the mandolin. Mostly it's people learn a stringed instrument and they go to the mandolin.
Right, yeah.
But not because your literally hands are so small.
My hands were so tiny, yeah.
Do you feel like that was a good lead into the guitar?
It's really, really different.
Because it is so different. I feel like it's a bit more advanced.
It is more advanced. And I think what it did for me is, even though I wasn't great at mandolin, I'm still terrible, but it did teach my right hand a lot about rhythm and making it hit the strings I want it to hit. So I didn't have to struggle when it came to guitar with how do I strum and what are the patterns. So I think that was probably beneficial, but I was just terrible.
You guys follow Ashley. She's got her own name, which sometimes is weird. People are like, hey, it's me. I'm Clint Black, but only Clint Black 1 on Twitter. And I'm like, well, you couldn't just get Clint Black? Not that that's the exact case, but at Ashley McBride, you guys go follow her. You know, go check out Never Will. Maybe if for some reason you've been in a cave and you don't know who she is and you're like, okay, this is interesting.
Yeah.
Go listen to the music.
Yeah.
I think you're one of, and I mean this in a complimentary way, you're one of the few album artists.
Thank you.
That I will invest time. I need a couple songs and I'm done. But
right.
there were a few. You, Casey, Old Dominion.
Yeah. Brandy's That Way.
And you know what? It's all songwriting. Now that I start to say this out loud, it's songwriting more than it is anything else. But you're definitely an album artist, and I don't know if that means anything
to you.
That's
a high compliment.
But thank you for coming, and I think we'll wrap it up there. All right, there she is, Ashley McBride.
This festival and concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your next stop before attending your next concert. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring. You're talking about men's boots, women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition, timeless style, always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort, little to no break-in period. Like, it's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Plus, direct-to-consumer pricing keeps the value on your feet, the money in your pocket. So stop by your local Tecovas store. Have a complimentary drink. Shop the new styles. You like the smell of leather or no?
I love it.
Yeah. That's what the whole store basically is. Fresh leather.
Yep.
Friendly staff. Or like the smell of staff?
I don't know. I guess I'm sure they smell good there.
Many stores have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. What a gift, too. Regular live music and events. There is no in-store experience like this. If you can't make it to a store, just visit Tecovas.com.
Tecovas.com.
Tecovas.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tecovas.com. Find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Hey, it's Bobby Bones. I just want to say thanks to everybody who has stepped up for the kids at St. Jude. St. Jude's been leading the way in the world's best survival rates for some of the most aggressive forms of childhood cancer. Your support means that families never get a bill from St. Jude for treatment or travel or housing or food, so the families can focus on helping their child live. And that really hits home for me because I've been to St. Jude many times. I've hung out with the kids, played music for the kids. I was in the hospital a lot as a kid. Now, I didn't have cancer, but if it wasn't for people stepping up, I don't know that I would have been able to go and stay in the hospital and be taken care of. So that's why we do this, to take care of others. You can help St. Jude stop childhood cancer by becoming a partner in hope. When you do this, you'll get this awesome new This Shirt Saves Lives shirt. So join all the doctors and researchers, you know, and me in this fight, and just text the word Bobby to 785-833. It's only six numbers, but text the word Bobby to 785-833.
This is the year to stop overpaying for your family plan. So choose a Straight Talk Wireless family plan. Unlimited data, talk, and text on a reliable 5G network. And you can get a new line starting at $25 per line per month for four lines, plus taxes and fees and no contracts. That's good decision making. Available at Walmart and on straighttalk.com. Family plan discount with four lines, all on the Silver Unlimited plan. Not combinable with auto pay discount. In times of traffic, your data may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Video streams at up to 480p.
Moving on to number seven, we're going to get into our conversation with singer-songwriter Luke Dick. Now, I booked this one personally, and I keep this running list of guests in my phone, just people I find interesting when it comes to, like, sometimes in the radio studio, people will come in and talk about different songwriters on their number one songs, and I'll always keep a list of those. And Luke Dick had been on my list for quite a while because he's written so many songs that I feel like are always a little bit outside of the box. I follow him on Instagram. Seemed like a very peculiar dude, so I thought getting him in a room with Bobby would be a great conversation. I actually DM'd him on Instagram. He was like, I'm totally down. Showed up the next week, and we did this episode. And I can always tell it's a really good Bobbycast episode whenever we get into like 20 minutes and haven't addressed any music whatsoever. Bobby and the guests have just been kind of talking about things outside of music. Those are always the best ones. So it happened on this episode at number seven. Here's Luke Dick.
And with Luke Dick, you know, I've seen many photos of you. I have friends who have worked with you. It's just random for me to have not have met someone until this point. Because you're a very established, you know, super well-thought-of guy, and our paths haven't crossed, have they?
I don't think so.
I don't either.
This is it.
I'm pretty forgettable, though. You are not a forgettable guy. I'm pretty forgettable.
I hide out, you know. I just got my little studio and come out. I eat now and again, and then I pick up my kids, and then I get back to doing whatever it is I'm doing.
What is your studio like?
You know, I bought this house right when I moved to Nashville, 6 or 7 years ago. And it was a garage in the back, and it was unfinished. And I thought that'd be a great place for just to have something close to the house, away from the house. And so then I put these opaque glass doors so I could have some light, and put a bunch of skylights in and really dressed it up and made it into a thing. And so that's where I am all the time. I'm currently looking for another spot. I have too many kids. They're beating on the door all the time. So,
are you, when you are writing in this room. I assume you do a lot of writing there.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're producing. Are you doing more than just demos? Like, will you do anything for a record in your spot?
Yeah. I'm working on the next Miranda Lambert record right now. We're almost done. And a lot of the stuff was when I do demos, I don't think of them as demos. I just am trying to make something that I love. And so I put more time and effort into it. And so maybe some of that stuff makes it onto the record. It may be the pre-production that we just drummed to. There was a single for Kip Moore called The Bull a few years ago that was just straight up out of my studio. So I'll do whatever out of there.
I was doing a little more research on it because my vision and version of you has been the last 10 years or so.
Mm.
But it seemed like for a while you weren't writing country music for a while. Now you're back. Like, why'd you quit? I wouldn't say quit. Why did you take a break and what brought you back?
Yeah. I came to Nashville for a minute and I just didn't have any luck. You know, I made a record. I was trying to get in a deal. There were things stacked against me just logistically in terms of being a single dad and stuff like this. And so I didn't, and also people weren't responding in a way. There were outliers, you know, that had some clout or something, said, I really love what you do, blah, 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 blah. But I was like, and this never amounted to anything. And it wasn't like people were picking up my songs. And I'm like, I either don't know how to do this, I'm not savvy enough, or it's just not good enough or something like that.
Did you never think you were ahead of your time?
I think that, like, looking back and listening to the record that I made, that's what it sounds like to me. But I also don't want to be, have delusions of grandeur or something like that. It's just like, music is important to me, but it's also just a snippet of life and reality. And it's a big part, you know, it's a big part. It gives me a lot of joy. But I also don't want to think in terms, like, I have a hard time thinking in terms of that you're ahead of your time and that's why it didn't work or whatever. And but then it didn't work. And so I left, and then my current publisher called me when I was in New York, and he said, hey, do you have any songs for Dierks Bentley? And I just said no. I mean literally everything that I've written has been in falsetto and also about the afterlife or some sort of afterlife adventure. I mean, it's too fantastical and whimsical for Dierks. I just don't, I thank you for calling me. but he will just look me up if you're ever in town. And then one thing led to another and a few years went by and we met and for coffee. And he's like, you need to come write with me and at this company. And you need to be writing with Eric and you don't need to be doing what you think you should be doing. You should be doing what you want to do. And hits will fall out of that, I promise you. And he was right. But between him and getting in the right rooms and having just the opportunity to show somebody like Eric Church a song or an idea for a song, that led to a lot of things. And Kip was a big proponent early on too. It was like, I didn't have any hits and he was coming over because he liked the sounds coming out of my studio, and we would work on stuff. And I think it was the Wild Ones record. I got a couple of songs on there and we just worked. But then Eric and then Nally Hemby and I started writing together, and it was like almost like we fed off of each other's creativity. And so we were like trying to not one up each other. It was like us like pushing each other, like trying to make each other like smile or get excited about a song. And so we'd bring in an idea or a sound or something like that. And that was a real joy. And then she would also sing my praises. It was like, I probably owe her $100,000 in PR fees, you know, around town. Brought Miranda into the room and that became a relationship. And it's meant a lot of joy and a lot of songs with her, but that was kind of the beginning of it. It was running into a publisher, who believed in what I did naturally instead of trying to curb it, to meet a market demand or something like that. And that's not really where I shine anyway. And I've, I find that if I feel like I'm a cat in a corner when I'm writing a song, then it's usually not going to be awesome. It's going to be an average kind of thing, day or whatever.
I've talked to Miranda and Cassie Ashton, Natalie Hemby, those that you mentioned there, and they all say the same thing about you, is that, you know, you're very out of the box and with ideas. I mean, that's the easy way to describe you to people who don't have to write songs. When you started writing with Eric, was he already having success, or was it early on?
It was the Mr. Misunderstood record, so he'd had a serious amount of success by the time I was writing with him.
So you start writing with him. I mean, to you as a creative, is that intimidating to write with him, or is it kind of refreshing? Because he also, you know, went a different angle at his success.
Yeah. I was in New York, and when I was living there, somebody showed me Smoke a Little Smoke, and they said, have you heard this? And I listened, and I'm like, is this what they're doing in Nashville now? And it gave me hope, you know, that there could be something creatively interesting, sonically interesting. And I feel like Jay Joyce kind of paved the way sonically for somebody like me to be here. I really have a lot of gratitude for what those two have done together. It's no small feat to break in with a different sound. But to more point at your question a little bit better, there's always a bit of intimidation. It doesn't matter how successful or not commercially successful the artist is coming in. So, but that was, you know, the first chance at an A-list situation for me to prove myself or whatever. But I had sent him this idea through my publisher that he loved, and it, you know, it was Kill a Word, and there was already an idea happening there in the first stanza and refrain, and he's like, I love this, let's finish it. And so he came in and we finished that, and then it was like, it took us like an hour to finish the song, and then it was me and him and Jeff Hyde, who plays in his band too, who's a great writer. And then he had the idea for Around Here Buzz. And so he kind of had a, he's around here, buzz. And so then we just sort of took off on that. And it just felt natural. Once you get in, everybody's a human, you know, it's like there's different kinds of magic to different human beings, you know, and Eric is definitely somebody with a special kind of charisma and a special kind of creative capacity and intellect to me. But as a human being, or trying to impress another human or something like that, it's like, look, you know, we all woke up today. We all needed breakfast and all that stuff. So let's just, you try to put stardom or something like that out of your head. I try to, and not be, I guess, motivated or dissuaded or feel insecure around that kind of a status. I'm trying to think if there was somebody that I'd be so starstruck that it would be difficult to write with. You know, Tom Waits, I don't know.
You kind of sound like Tom Waits right now when you're talking.
I'm Bob Dylan, I guess. You know, if you had to go write a song with Bob Dylan, that would probably be one of the most intimidating things, situation. I remember, this is not an intimidating person, but this guy came over, and he was an Englishman, and he had these hits in the 80s, these pop rock hits, and they were really good ones. And I kept playing like guitar stuff, and he's like, he'd look at me and he'd go, oh, that's not very inspiring, is it? What do you do to that? You know, I'm just like, what do you got? And he's like, I'm more of a lyrics guy. Here's a list of titles. And the titles were like, All Night Long, All Night, All of Everything. And I'm just like, are you fucking kidding me? What is this?
Are you a lyric or a melody guy at heart when you start to write?
I can't separate them really, you know. When Natalie, it's different for different rooms. When I get around Natalie and I have a melody already with something and with the phrasing and she wants to change the melody, I usually defer to her because I really believe in her abilities to make a melody. There are a few other people like that that I, when they say, man, I think this melody could be better, I'm like, all right, let's check it. Let's scrap it. Let's see what's up. I really want to marry it all because you can't just send somebody the lyrics to a song and expect it to speak to them off of a page. I mean, there's a whole thing happening there. It's like, that's the beauty of music or songs in general, is that there's a sound, there's a, you know, there's a chord progression, there's a lyric, and there's a melody on top of it. So it's hard for me to say that I'd be one thing.
When you write, are you writing based on, will you just chase lyrics, or will you sometimes just create a melody and then insert lyrics into it later?
Both. Laura Velz does this to me. I hope she's listening right now, because when we write, I'll turn around and I'll start, try to get the track going. You know, it's like, okay, we got the first verse. Let me just put a little bass part in here. I'll turn around, and Laura's such a prolific lyricist that she'll be done with the second verse. I'm like, wait a minute, I like this song. Can I participate, please? Hold on. Chew, you know, have a story. Eat some chips or something, and let me do this bass part, and I'll contribute. There have been times that the melody has come first. You know, it's like, you know, you start playing and something will just spill out of you, and then you just work around the vowels. The vowels might lead you to a phrase or something like that, you know. I read the Keith Richards book, and he talked about the way that they did that, and I don't think it's uncommon to do that. Life, that's the book from Keith Richards, and he said, he had a name for it, you know, the way that they do it, but it's, you know, you're just playing a chord, and you're, and so then whatever vowel you sing that feels the most natural, you might lean toward a word with that vowel sound. And then you have to work the concept around the vowel sound or something like that. You know, songwriting is really weird, but, I do find that when I listen to songs and I feel like that's a good melody, those are the wrong vowel sounds or something, you know, I'm like, I can't understand the lyric. The lyric's not sticking out to me because it's all mushed in there in a way, and the vowels aren't popping, and there's too many words or too not enough words. So there's like an economy, and that's all subjective too, right? It's just like, that sounds like too many words to me. It doesn't sound like too many words to that artist or that person singing it.
I'm going to compare you as a lyricist and a songwriter to Eminem, which you may have never been compared to, but
whoa.
When I listen to Eminem, he bends rhymes. Sometimes he doesn't rhyme, but still rhymes. And a lot of, or at least some of your writing, you don't even chase a rhyme. There just aren't rhymes where there should be, where traditionally rhymes are. I shouldn't say should be rhymes.
Yeah, yeah.
There aren't rhymes where traditionally rhymes are.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that purposeful on your part to not put rhymes there, or is it just purposeful to put those words there and they just don't happen to rhyme?
I feel like when you get down to it, it's like, especially if you're chasing a lyric and it's like, is this lyric working? Is this idea working? You just run with it. And then I don't want to say it's not intentional. Like the way to say it's not my intention to say every song needs to rhyme like this, or let's try some rhymes in the middle of this phrases rather than at the end of the phrases, which is typical. I feel like you just, all you're left with in any creative endeavor is your own aesthetic intuition, and you have to go with what moves you. And when anytime, I mean, there's been countless artists that come in and we end up with a song that I don't care about. And that's okay, because they're saying, no, I don't want to do this because I want to do that. And I'm like, well, that does not in my head, you know, or heart or whatever. I'm like, well, that doesn't do anything for me, but it's your career, you know, it's your artistic impulse that you're chasing. So chase it then. And I hope that I hope it works if I like you.
And the demo to Kill a Word.
Yeah.
Which is you singing.
Yeah.
Which we have it right here.
Oh, well.
I'd like to play a little bit of it here.
I'd put upset down in its place. I'd squeeze the life out of disgrace. Lay over under 6 cold feet of dirt. If I could only kill a word.
So... Have you not heard that?
You
in a
while? Steal that? Do you steal that?
How we
you
were at your that? House last night. We're in the back. That's why I know so much about your studio.
Hacked your computer.
Broke in last night.
Wow. How do you change the code?
Why is it how prevalent is it that if you're writing with or for like an Eric, that person doesn't sing the demo? And is that purposeful so the demo doesn't get out with his voice on it?
It wasn't purposeful. He just said, put your vocal on it. I like what you're doing. I'm out. Do your thing. I want to hear what you do. And then there's sometimes where, especially if it's a female artist, where I'm less inclined to go do a vocal on it. And for a couple of reasons, one is it's shrewd, you know, it's like if they just hear a dude on there, then it sounds like a dude song, you know, but if you write it with the artist who's female and then another female artist, the other female writer, if the other female writer sings it, it makes more sense to me. But I don't like really, I feel like it shoots you in the foot a little bit. Unless it's somebody like Miranda that we know each other well enough to where it's like, not like she's like, oh, this doesn't sound like it. She can hear through that stuff. I trust her to hear through that stuff. But generally, if an artist is there, and especially if it's an artist that I don't work with that often, I'm going to try to get them to sing it because I want to hear what they sound like on it too. And also see if you did okay or you didn't. What I mean by that is sometimes you write all these melodies, you write this song and somebody sings on it, just doesn't sound good, you know? And so if you're off the mark in terms of a melodic structure or something like that, you'll be able to hear it when they get on the microphone. It's like, they're not really capable of singing that, or they are really great at it, or it's kind of in the middle. Maybe we shouldn't have gone that high and you change the key, those kind of technical decisions like that. So if we're the only writers in the room, oftentimes I get tasked with singing the demo on it. And I'm generally happy to do that. It's fun to me. It's a creative endeavor, especially if I love the song.
When Bluebird comes out and it's a massive radio success, and I think it was the first massive radio song for Miranda in a long time. Mm-hmm. I remember her saying that, like, yeah, you know, she had just had a record that double album had done so wonderful, but mm-hmm. it didn't translate into singles. But Bluebird comes and just crushes. It's number one and was 1-2 Grammys?
No, we nominated for 2 Grammys.
You nominated for 2 Grammys? Yeah. Did you go?
It was when COVID was happening.
Yeah, so you still...
No, I bought a suit and in my closet it sits.
So you didn't even put it on for the night of, as they were doing it on the internet? No. So is that cool to you to be nominated for a Grammy, or is it to you, is that just a piece of metal that represents, and what does representation even mean?
I would really be lying if I didn't say that I would not want to win a Grammy. I mean, I would love to say that I won a Grammy. Sometimes I catch myself, you know, when you win something, and it's like, I'm always thankful to win something. There is a truth for me to the fact that when you write a song like that, that is really meaningful to you, that nothing compares to the day that you wrote it with your friends. And then you heard and then you played it back and you heard and you sang on it and you listened to the demo and you get excited about it. Nothing compares to that joy. Winning awards is, it's another, like, just kind of hurrah at the end, you know, that the hard work and the beautiful work is already done. And Amy Poehler calls it the pudding. You know, you've already eaten the meat and all that stuff, and pudding is nice, you know, but you don't need it. You're already full, kind of everything. That said, if the Grammy, any Grammy voters are out there, if I'm up for anything next year, please vote for me.
At Luke Dick. Luke, thanks, man.
Thank you.
This festival and concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your next stop before attending your next concert. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring. Talking about men's boots, women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition, timeless style, always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort, little to no break-in period. Like, it's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Plus, direct consumer pricing keeps the value on your feet, the money in your pocket. So stop by your local Tecovas store. Have a complimentary drink. Shop the new styles. You like the smell of leather or no?
I love it.
Yeah. That's what the whole store basically is. Fresh leather.
Yep.
Friendly staff. Or like the smell of staff?
I don't know. I'm sure they smell good there.
Many stores have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. What a gift, too. Regular live music and events. There is no in-store experience like this. If you can't make it to a store, just visit tecovas.com.
T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. T-E-C-O-V-A-S.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tecovas.com. Find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Hey, it's Amy Brown here to talk about the incredible work that's being done by St. Jude Children's Research Hospital and to ask you today to join me in becoming a partner in HOPE. When you make a donation to St. Jude, you're helping an organization that has helped push the overall childhood cancer survivor rate from 20% to more than 80%. And I can tell you from personal experience, that number and the hope that it brings is invaluable. Families do not have to worry about a thing. Treatment is covered, travel, housing, food. And when you're a family that's going through this, like imagine you're a parent, your kid gets cancer. You need to focus on that child. You don't need to be worrying about other things. And financial stuff can get really stressful. St. Jude covers it. Your support means families never receive a bill from St. Jude for treatment. And when you sign up for just $19 a month, you're going to get the new This Shirt Saves Lives tee. So join me in helping St. Jude in the fight against childhood cancer. Become a partner in HOPE and text Bobby to 785-833. That's B-O-B-B-Y to 785-833.
This is the year to stop overpaying for your family plan. So choose a Straight Talk Wireless family plan. Unlimited data, talk, and text on a reliable 5G network. And you can get a new line starting at $25 per line per month for 4 lines, plus taxes and fees and no contracts. That's good decision making. Available at Walmart and on straighttalk.com. Family plan discount with 4 lines, all on the Silver Unlimited plan. Not combinable with auto pay discount. In times of traffic, your data may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Video streams at up to 480p.
At number 6 is Parker McCollum, who is one of Bobby's favorite new artists. And we recorded this episode earlier in the year when he was really starting to blow up, had just moved to Nashville. He's such a nice guy. He pulled up in his really big truck. And the thing I found interesting is that he called Bobby Sir. Seemed like one of the most genuine dudes in country music. And really cool to see him blow up this year, even after we did this episode. So at number 6, here is Parker McCollum.
Here with Parker McCollum. Talk to me about the beginning of music for you. When did you start playing, I won't say bars, but maybe that's where you started. How old were you? Were you a teenager trying to play places? And what were those places?
Yeah, and I grew up in a town just north of Houston called Conroe. I went to high school in a town called The Woodlands, which is like 5 miles from it.
We had a bunch of shows at The Woodlands. Yeah. Theater there.
Yeah, we're headlining it for I graduated high school on that stage, and we're headlining it in October. I'm like,
that's pretty cool. Yeah. Cool.
But there wasn't much of a music scene down there. Especially for, there wasn't any country. Every kid in my high school wanted to be a rapper. Like, I was listening to Old Crow and Robert Earl Keane and Randy Rogers Band, and nobody I grew up with listened to that stuff. My older brother and stuff. But so that's what kind of made me go to Austin. I wanted to go find a bunch of people who were kind of like-minded into the same stuff. But I think I had my first paying gig. I played on a flatbed trailer in Giddings, Texas, the Hayseed Festival, maybe.
How old?
I was 16. My mom let me drive myself. And then she showed up to make sure I got there safely.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. I mean, I guess now it's cool, but at the time I was like, what are you doing
here? That's true. It's cool that here's what was cool. She let you drive by yourself and then trailed you. She didn't go, I'll drive you.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it was, looking back, it's super cool that she was there, because that guy ended up paying me like 9 months later, I think, like $75.
He waited that long. He probably was trying to get away with not paying
me. He sent me a check. Yeah.
So you play this at 16. Were you going, this would be fun because I like to play a little guitar? Or were you going, heck, I'm 16. I think I'm going to do this for my career?
I knew when I was like a junior in high school is when I really started. My brother and sister were older. They were both in college at the time. So I was like the baby. I was the last one. The reins were kind of looser on me. My mom was not near as strict on me my last years of high school as she was my siblings. So I was sneaking out in my bedroom window on the roof, you know, every night, coming back in and wigging out, trying to write songs. And that's really when, and I was like, all right, I don't stand out at sports. That was okay. Wasn't anything special. But I could play guitar and write songs and sing way better than any of my friends. And that's when I was kind of like, all right, this is it for me.
Were you the music kid? Maybe not the band kid, but were you the kid who played music in high school? They know you as that?
Oh, yeah.
If there was a party, would you ever have your guitar to play?
Every now and then they'd get me to do it. But, I mean, again, I was playing, like, you know, Randy Rogers songs and Pat Green songs and stuff. Like, they weren't. Those kids were like, who? So.
And did you decide you were going to wait till you graduated high school to move off?
Well, I had to. You know, it's not that I didn't get into college. I didn't exactly apply. I filled out my name for a couple schools on the form, and then once they sent back insufficient application letters, I was like, Mom, I'm just going to go to Austin Community College, and just like move to Austin. And it really, I knew I wasn't going there to go to school. So I enrolled. I was enrolled for a year.
Did you go to class at all?
A couple times.
Nice.
I actually ended up not going to class, but my business professor I'd met on like the first day, we ended up becoming good buddies, and we would hang out outside of class all the time, but I never went to his class. He's a super cool guy. And, but I was just, it was really just a means to get to Austin. And, man, I met Corby Schaub at the Saxon Pub on South Lamar, who had just quit Ryan Bingham and the Dead Horses, who were my favorite band in the world at the time. I thought they walked on water.
When you say met him, though, were you both hanging out? Were you trying to play? Were you asking if you could play?
I was not playing there yet. In fact, it might have been the exact next day that David Cotton, who used to book those clubs down there, called me and was like, can you play tomorrow night at the Saxon? And I was like, dude, I only got like 5 songs. And he's like, well, play them all 3 times. And
how did he know you played?
A girl named Ashley Monacle was there that night who had, I'd kind of, she thought I was good and was trying to get me to meet some people. And she was like, you need to hear this kid. And he didn't even listen. He was just like, all right, cool. You can play here tomorrow night.
So you met the guy before you even played there.
Mm-hmm.
And what did that relationship turn into?
He ended up producing the Limestone Kid, my first record. Cause he was in original Dead Horses with Ryan Bingham, like through Mescalito and Roadhouse Sun, two of my favorite records of all time. And so when I was in the bar that night, and I was only 20 at the time, I was in there with a fake ID. They ended up finding out. I'd played there a couple times, and then they made me stop playing there until I was 21, and I was allowed to come back. But I met him, and I remember that night, I was like, dude, you play guitar for Ryan Bingham. And he was like, no, I did play guitar. He's like, I just quit the band, like the week before. And I was just crushed. And then like 2 weeks later, that same girl was like, hey, come over to my house. Corby's over here doing some demos for me. And I had just written 2 of those songs on that first record like the day before and played them for him. And he was like, man, let me produce your record. So I don't think he had ever produced a record before.
But so what does that mean to you, let me produce your record? How many songs did you have? Or did you go, I'm not there yet, let me write some more? What was that?
I actually, the songs I had, there was the money problem. That, and I had my, and my dad's a very successful guy. He had offered to do it, pay for all of that. And I just respectfully declined because I wanted to do it on my own. So I actually went and took out a loan. And that was quite a process to not have, I had no credit or anything, had my granddad co-sign on it. Once I got the money, it was like, okay. And then I didn't take out enough. He was like, all right, well, we have enough for 4 songs. So we did a 4-song EP, which was called A Red Town View. And he's like, when you get some more money, we'll go in and do the full album. And so I went and took out another loan, and those 4 songs kind of compiled with the other 6 to make, or 7 to make an 11-song album.
Were you playing a bunch as you're making this record? Because it sounds like when you met him, you were not playing that often.
A little bit. My dad was, I was living with my brother, my older cousin, in this house in South Austin, Manchac and Slaughter, if you know.
Oh, I used to live right there. I used to live Brody and Slaughter.
Yeah.
So you're talking about one road difference.
Yes. And I was living there. I was enrolled in school. And man, I was unmotivated. I didn't know what I was doing. I had no idea how to go get a gig that someone hadn't just handed me. And so my brother actually one day was like, I think he's 6 years older than I am. So I think he kind of saw me just sort of not doing anything, but I think he thought I was talented. And my brother's a phenomenal songwriter, so he's a very good judge of that. I remember him saying to me one night, he's like, dude, just go book 30 shows in 30 days and see if you can ever quit. He's like, play those and see if you ever stop. I didn't get 30 in 30 days, but I ended up playing like 12 shows that month, and I've been playing ever since.
So as you're performing and you have this record, are you selling it at the table? What are you doing with that record?
I had paid a guy to print, I want to say like 250 copies, maybe 300 copies. And I just always kept them with me, and I would just hand them out everywhere I went. Like, do you know Steamboat Music Festival?
I do.
I used to go up there and as a fan. And my buddy's parents would actually take him and I. They're big music fans. And they paid for me to go 1 year, and I walked around the lobby handing out that EP.
So you're just handing them out. You weren't selling them.
No.
You were like, anybody listen to this.
Yeah, just take a listen. And then right before COVID, we headlined the whole festival, closed it out. So it's kind of a cool little story. But It was very, I'm the luckiest human in my mind to ever live. Like, I mean, it exactly how I thought and dreamed about it happening when I was 17 is besides COVID, clearly, which is probably for everybody. Exactly how I dreamed about it and thought it and hoped it would happen and wanted it to happen when I was 17 is exactly how it's gone.
So who saw you and said, dang, I would like to invest my brain power, my money, my time into making this person a better artist? Like, who was the first person to take a chance on you?
Corby Schaub was really the first person to take a chance on me, but, I mean, I went and took out the money. He just thought I was good, wanted to produce my record, thought it was worth his time. The first person to really go, you got it, I can help you, was Randy Rogers from the Randy Rogers Band.
And where did you meet Randy?
I was first of four, opening for him and two other bands in Corpus Christi one day. We had a van. We didn't have a trailer then. We took out the back seat, and all the gear was in the back of the van. And I listened. I'd been obsessed with him my whole life. You know, he was like royalty down there to me. And we were opening for him. We just pulled up. I remember we pulled up in the van. I look at my tour manager at the time, Jake Murphy, and I was like, all right, well, let's get out and go talk. We'd been playing quite a few shows at that point. Just nothing. I mean, no-go shows, terrible stuff. And but we were touring a lot. And I remember looking at him, and I was like, let's go talk to a bunch of people who don't want to talk to us. Well, we open the van. Randy Rogers comes walking up. He's got on Gucci shades, 5950 hat, van shoes, jorts, gold chain, Rolly on his wrist, like, not what you think Randy Rogers is going to walk up. I mean, he looks so G. I remember he walked up and he was like, you guys need anything, let me know. I was like, all right, that's cool. He's a headliner to come and, you know, at least holler at us. And then he said, actually, we went and played our show at like 3:30 in the afternoon. I looked over on the side of the stage and he watched our whole set. And then 5 hours later, he plays his show at 10 o'clock at night. And I was standing side stage for his show and he walked off and I'd never been on a tour bus. And he's like, let's go to the bus. As he walked off stage, and we went to the bus and went to the back lounge, and he just lounged and he sat down and he was like, look, I've been doing some research on you. I'd only had that one record, the Limestone Kid, out, and he's like, this record is phenomenal. He's like, you can be a star. That night he was like, you have star power, you could be a star. I just want to help you avoid some of the mistakes I made. I would love to help you get there. I don't want anything from you, I just want to help. So go home and think about it if that's something you want to do. And I actually ended up was trying to call my mom, trying to call my dad, trying to call my brother. Everybody was asleep. And I was freaking out. And I was like, Randy Rogers. Once he had just started a management company. And he didn't really have any. But I think he was doing some stuff with Bruce Robinson at the time and maybe someone else. But they needed like a kind of a main focus and right place, right time kind of thing, I guess. But he took time out of his life to come to Nashville and go into Universal Records and Big Machine. And
so he came and did the pitches with you.
Yeah, he had a condo up here still, and he let me come up here and stay in his condo for free and write and got me a publishing deal. Walked into every major label in town and said, if you pass on this kid, you're passing on the next George Strait, which, overhyping it, I would say quite a bit. He's setting me up to fail, but he's a family man. He has a wife and kids, and he's got a whole life outside of touring, and he plays 150 shows a year, and he would take time to fly up here on a weekly basis with me and write and get me in rooms and go in there and say crazy outlandish things like that to major labels. And got me a record deal, publishing deal. I call him dad for a reason. People always ask why I call him dad. So
when you started to do the tour of A.M. Parker, I know you have a record, your big fancy record label. Mm-hmm. How did that go for you? Was the first one easy or was it weird? How many did you go through until you settled on where you are now?
We met with all the majors, and then I think we met with Big Loud as well. And kind of before that, a lot of smaller labels had been kind of coming to Austin and whining and dining and doing that kind of thing where they take you out and they do the whole thing, which was really cool in its own right. I had never had any record label, you know, kind of holler at it at any capacity. And so once the majors really came out and we're like, and once one of them does, it's kind of like they all come calling. It's kind of like a bidding war. Even if they like you or not, I think they just don't want to miss out more. And they don't want to be told no, which I completely understand that. But I remember sitting there, Enzo remembers it too. I mean, I just, you know, you have every major label in country music sitting there going, you know, what? And we already had a huge touring base and generated quite a bit of revenue touring. So I kind of had all the leverage was on our side. We kind of had, we're in the driver's seat. And they offered a bunch of money up front and all this stuff. And I said, look, I don't want your money. I said, I want creative control. I was like, I just want to be able, my whole dream was to be on a major label with creative control and be able to do what I want to do. If it doesn't work, cool. That's it. You know, I don't think you'll ever lose money. We already make you enough money as we tour. But I mean, I bet on me because I'll bet on myself for sure. And, you know, it probably, I don't know how it came off at the time, but I guess it worked because they all made great offers. And I was able to counter and get the deal that I wanted. So
you get to decide.
Yeah.
So at what point do you start preparing your major, what we'll call it, major label debut? Like, do you start immediately? Did you already have the song that you led with? Like,
I did not. I had, well, I guess Randy Montana was like my first co-write in town, first real co-write. And I'd wanted to go in. I'd never really co-written before, besides with my older brother. And so I wanted to come in and have like a good idea. So I'd found this video of me like singing this song. It was, "What does that say about me? I could love somebody like you," was the original line. And it was the melody that Pretty Heart is. And I was like, man, how did I forget about that? I'm going to take that in tomorrow. And so we ended up writing that song. And I think I signed my deal not just a few months after that. I think that's the right timeline. And so I signed the deal and I was like, these are the songs I have. And they were like, that's the one.
Oh, so it was immediate. They knew, you knew, yeah. All good.
But it didn't, we were cut it and then it didn't, hell, I don't know if it came, it probably didn't come out for close to a year. Yeah, we were just kind of sitting.
Did that process feel like it was taking forever?
Yeah, I was really, which I mean, I told myself in the beginning, I was like, don't go in here and it's really easy to, you know, anything that's worth working really hard for. I mean, you know, probably just as well as anybody, like, as soon as it starts, something's going to go wrong. Something's not going to be what someone promised, whatever. So I just kind of kept that in mind. And I was like, man, just, you signed the deal. I was like, just trust the process. I was like, these people have done it. You know, you're the 1,000,000th artist that they've promoted and put on the big stage. And I was like, and he talked me through a lot of that. You know, he's been through it 100 times.
What'd you do during that whole time though, while you're waiting? Were you just writing?
Writing. And I was coming up here and writing. I'd had my publishing deal for a year at that point. So I was writing a lot. But I was touring. We were still playing 150 shows a year. So I was as busy as I could be. I mean, when I say I wasn't home more than 2 days at a time for 4 years, that is no exaggeration. I would get off the bus in Austin on Sunday, take the last Southwest flight out on Sunday evening to Nashville, write and go to meetings Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and fly right back Wednesday night. And
do it again.
Go on the road, yeah, for like 3 years.
Any of your music friends in Texas for moving to Nashville?
Nah. Everybody loves it, dude.
Is that because I feel like that stage is kind of over as well.
Yeah. I mean, dude, I made it very clear from the start. And I was like, I grew up idolizing George Strait. You know, he has 60 number ones, probably more, I think two or three more than that, maybe 62, 63, something like that now. He's the epitome of what I think anybody should aspire to be in country music. And he sold out AT&T Stadium back-to-back nights, residency in Vegas, Madison Square Garden, you name it. There's nothing he hasn't done in the business. He's a king. And so that was always, I was like, man, just, you're never going to, I'll never get to that level. But try to, you know, and maybe you get halfway there. That's pretty damn good. And so I always made it really clear that was my goal. But it was always my goal to do it on really, I was raised on songwriters. Really, really talented, you know, honest songwriting. And so the goal was always to go to that level and be on country radio without sounding like, you know, everything else that is coming out on country radio. And there's a dude, I say that all the time. People are like, whoa, be careful. I'm like, a majority of that stuff I really enjoy. I really like it. It doesn't matter what genre it is or songs I don't like. But I like the majority of stuff on country radio. I just think that there's a gap in a space for someone that's younger. Like Chris Stapleton's phenomenal. He's an anomaly, right? Like as talented as a human being can be, but he's a little older. There's no like young kids, younger generation that are super like hung up on songwriting that are on commercial radio, country radio. And I just was like, maybe I could do that.
I'm going to play a little bit of To Be Loved By You. Sure. Here is the current single.
So why are you always angry? Why are you always quiet? Why do you sleep alone when
went there with Rhett Akins.
I did.
That's pretty cool.
Thank you, man.
I mean, I love Rhett.
Oh, dude, he's a G.
Just as a kid, you're, you know, obviously younger than I am, but as a kid, Rhett was on the radio all the time when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. Like, was a fan of him as an artist, and now, you know, getting to know him personally, and I just, Rhett, I think he was playing, we were playing the Opry together, and I was doing comedy after he was playing, but right before he went out there, he pulled the biggest dip out of his mouth. Right before he walked in, he went, pulled out, threw it in the cup, and walked right on stage. I was like, that's disgusting and awesome, and that's the most Rhett Akins thing I've ever seen in my life.
Redman Silver Label.
Yeah.
Every time we write together, I hope he doesn't mind me saying this. Sorry, Rhett, if you do. He will chew an entire, I've seen him go through more than one, an entire bag of Redman Silver Label. And we're there for 3 hours. You've seen how big a bag. It's not a can of dip. It's a bag of chew.
It's disgusting.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's disgusting, but I'm glad I got to see it. Like, I would expect nothing less from Rhett. When you write this song with him, who, by the way, as an artist, fantastic, but as a songwriter, even better, like Rhett throughout his career.
Yeah. He gets both sides of it. Yeah.
Whenever you write this song, was this one of those where you're like, yeah, this is special? Or what, did it become special after, you know, you cut it? Or like, what process was this song special?
Man, none of them are really special to me when I write them. And I think it's because I get so, like, when I come up with this melody that I'm obsessed with or this idea or whatever, I get so excited then. And then I write it and I'm like, oh, it's super cool. And then I just forget about it. Like, I don't even think twice about it. But this, I had actually written the first verse and a chorus on the back of the bus. At like 11 o'clock in the morning, we were going on the road. We'd just gotten on the bus. Excuse me. And we just got on the bus. I was in the back lounge, and I wrote it down. I'd actually said out loud, me and Hallie Ray were arguing at the time, having a little whatever. And I said out loud, I was like, man, what does a man have to do to be loved by that girl? And he kind of perked up. He's like, yeah, you might want to write that down. And so in 15 minutes, I went back and wrote the first verse and the chorus. And then same thing. I just forgot about it. Didn't even think about it. And then I had a write with Rhett. And when Rhett and I write, it's not like any other co-write. Like, we'll go sit for the first hour, you know, he's having a chew. I'll probably bum some off him a lot of the time. And we just talk about, like, turkey hunting or deer hunting for an hour. Or, like, he's showing me pictures of all the deer he shot or out at one of his farms here in Nashville. And then he'll be like, hey, so do you have anything? And that day, it was like a few days after I'd written that, or maybe a couple weeks. And I was like, dude, I have this. And he was just like, all right, we'll finish it. And I was like, okay, whatever. And then he was on his phone, and I kept being like, what do you think about this? And he'd be like, yeah, how about this? And I'd be like, all right, what about this? And he'd be like, yeah, how about this for the second verse? And it was really slow. It was not like this big rock and roll kind of Rolling Stones feel thing that it is now. And we did a little work tape, and I left. And then we went going into the studio like 3 months later. And I was like, man, I remember talking to my producer, John Randall. I was like, this song could be this. And most of the time, I'm wrong in the studio. I've learned that. I learned that very early on. Most of the time, I'm wrong. But every now and then, I'm like, dude, just give this a shot. And we recorded it. And then Rhett called me like probably 2 months after that. Someone had sent him a rough mix. And he was like, did we write that together? And I was like, yeah, remember we finished it that day at your management, or I think it's his publishing office that he has. And he was like, dude, that's insane. And I was like, dude, the song's, I was like, and I'm never hyped on my own stuff. I never think very much of it. I get over it very quickly. I'm on to the next thing very quickly. And that was like probably one of two ever that I've been like, yeah, this is dope for sure. And probably more so because he thought so.
Your EP, six songs, it's out now. Six songs, right?
Hollywood Gold, yeah.
And five of them you wrote. One of them is a Stapleton cut. Yeah. How'd you get that song?
Man, that was my first outside cut on Universal. That's the only song I've ever cut that I didn't write on Universal. And I was driving to the ranch one day. I was in my truck. And I got a text message from Brian Wright at the label. And it was just a audio clip on a text. And it just said Stapleton/Anderson. And I'm like, he's on Universal as well, Stapleton. So I was like, oh, maybe this is one of the perks of like being on the same label. You get to listen to his record before it comes out. Well, I listened to the song and I called Brian. I'm like, yo, that's insane. Like, what an incredible song. And he's like, yeah, Stapleton never cut it. I was like, what do you mean? He's like, yeah, he wrote it in like 2006 or something, or whenever he wrote it, a long time ago. And I was like, he's like, do you think you would want to cut it? And I was like, dude, I sent it to my dad, and he was like, that's the best song you've ever written. And I was like, nah, I didn't write that. I was like, but I am going to sing it. And I was like, instantly, I just connected. They sent me out. They send me outside songs all the time. That's the only one I've ever been like, I'm cutting that song.
All right, there he is, Parker McCollum.
This festival and concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your next stop before attending your next concert. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring. You're talking about men's boots, women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition, timeless style, always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort, little to no break-in period. Like, it's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Plus, direct consumer pricing keeps the value on your feet, the money in your pocket. So stop by your local Tecovas store. Have a complimentary drink. Shop the new styles. You like the smell of leather or no?
I love it.
Yeah. That's what the whole store basically is. Fresh leather.
Yep.
Friendly staff. Or like the smell of staff?
I don't know. I guess I'm sure they smell good there.
Many stores have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. What a gift, too. Regular live music and events. There is no in-store experience like this. If you can't make it to a store, just visit Tecovas.com. Tecovas.com.
Tecovas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tecovas.com. Find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Hey, it's Bobby Bones. I just want to say thanks to everybody who has stepped up for the kids at St. Jude. St. Jude's been leading the way in the world's best survival rates for some of the most aggressive forms of childhood cancer. Your support means that families never get a bill from St. Jude for treatment or travel or housing or food, so the families can focus on helping their child live. And that really hits home for me because I've been to St. Jude many times. I've hung out with the kids, played music for the kids. I was in the hospital a lot as a kid. Now, I didn't have cancer, but if it wasn't for people stepping up, I don't know that I would have been able to go and stay in the hospital and be taken care of. So that's why we do this, to take care of others. You can help St. Jude stop childhood cancer by becoming a partner in hope. When you do this, you'll get this awesome new This Shirt Saves Lives shirt. So join all the doctors and researchers, you know, and me in this fight, and just text the word Bobby to 785-833. It's only six numbers, but text the word Bobby to 785-833.
This is the year to stop overpaying for your family plan. So choose a Straight Talk wireless family plan. Unlimited data, talk, and text on a reliable 5G network. And you can get a new line starting at $25 per line per month for four lines, plus taxes and fees and no contracts. That's good decision making. Available at Walmart and on straighttalk.com. Family plan discount with four lines, all on the Silver Unlimited plan. Not combinable with auto pay discount. In times of traffic, your data may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Video streams at up to 480p.
At number five, we're going with Matthew Ramsey of Old Dominion. And I really love the episodes when we just get a member of a group because I think that's when you get the best stories. And Old Dominion is always one of the hardest interviews we have to prepare for when they come on the Bobby Bones Show because there is so many members of the group. It's hard to focus your time on every single member. So I love it when we're able to do these Bobby casts and get just one of the members of the group to talk about their path, get their side of how the group started, and when it comes to Matthew Ramsey's case, all the number one songs he's written outside of Old Dominion. And we had Trevor Rosen on from the group before, so I always wanted to get Matthew Ramsey in to do an episode, and it happened this year. We learned so much about him that we didn't know. So at number five, here's Matthew Ramsey of Old Dominion.
All right, with Matthew Ramsey from Old Dominion, in your band, because everybody kind of has roles in Old Dominion, like, what is your role creatively in that group?
Creatively, I mean, it's tough because we are, that's what makes it really hard to be in this band sometimes is everyone is extremely creative. So, you know, at any more, I would say that it's kind of evolved and I've recently learned, especially in this last album, in the process of making it, that my role is not necessarily in the tracking room while we're recording. It's in the control room with our producer Shane, and I'm a better guide in that way, and I'm a strong writer, I think, too. So I think I have a strong voice in the writing of our songs, but everyone does. Everyone is so talented.
Do you have to submit?
Frustrating.
And is it, you were using the word frustrating? Do you have to submit yourself a bit when you go to record an album? Because when you write it and you make, you know, your work tape or your demo, and you have you can get demo-itis and want it to sound like that.
Sure.
But then Shane comes in, Shane McAnally, who obviously is the best at what he does.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't think you would have a problem with saying he's better at being a producer than you are.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure.
I want to make sure we're cool there.
Yeah.
And if he's like, hey, this is how I see it. Like, I really am passionate about this. Do you ever have to submit and go like, you know what? You know what you're doing, and I only kind of know what I'm doing, so I'm going to do that.
Yeah, definitely. But we have a close enough relationship that we'll go down that road. If we're not fully believing in it and I'm not fully believing in it, but he strongly is, we'll go down that road for however long it takes until we see it or we go, you're wrong. And he's great at going, okay, thanks for trying. And we do the same thing. He'll listen to us and our ideas. And, you know, if we are feeling it one way, he'll say, I trust you guys. Let's go down that road until he either sees it or doesn't.
It seems, this is just my memory years later, that he was involved really early with you guys.
Yeah, he was, you know, we were writing music with him, songs, before he had any success. So I think when I met him, he had just gotten Leanne Womack's song recorded. It was his first one. And, you know, we were all just broke. You know, I think he had just like moved out of his car into a house, you know. So, yeah, he's been around for us since the beginning.
I want to go back to in Virginia. The first instrument you pick up, is it the drums?
It was the drums, yeah.
Why the drums?
I had an older brother, and he's 4 years older than me, and he had a friend who was a drummer, and it just enamored me. He would come over to our house and set his drum kit up, and I would sneak down there and look at it. And then he played like a drum solo at the middle school talent show or whatever. It blew the whole place's mind, and I just saw how that affected everyone. And so I just was drawn to banging on stuff.
Were there bands that you listened to and drummed along with and you liked the most as a 14, 15-year-old kid where you thought, all right, if I'm going to do this?
Yeah. I mean, at that point, it was starting to get into a lot of grunge.
I mean, for me, when I first learned how to play guitar, it was Chili Peppers.
Right.
And it was Metallica because they had some really easy intros.
Totally. Yeah, yeah. So I had, at that point, once I started really digging in and playing along to music, my parents had a basement and I had a drum kit down there and I had guitar amps and guitars and it was kind of like split even then. I had half of the basement was art supplies and canvases and things, and half of it was musical instruments. So I would just kind of live down in the basement and play along to mostly things like Pearl Jam and Nirvana and Smashing Pumpkins and stuff like that.
I'm going to ask this question, and I'm being as respectful as I possibly can with this question because what happened to me may have happened to you, but being an art kid and a music kid, did you get beat up a lot?
I never got beat up, but I definitely, I got tugged on a little bit, you know. I've never really talked about this ever, but I actually ended up getting plastic surgery on my ears because they were yanked on quite a bit. And they were like, you know, I always think about this. It must have been really bad because I kind of don't think about it that much, but it must have been really bad for me to beg my parents to fix this problem and for them to go through with it. Because, I have kids and I know if a kid my kid in the sixth grade was begging, you know, me to physically change them because of what people were doing, it must have been heartbreaking for my parents. And I know it was tough for me. So,
right.
So they did. So for a while there, yes, I went through some, you know, some harder, you know, punishments there.
I suffered similar,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Consequences for not being a, you know, finger quotes, normal kid.
Right.
But you're a lot cooler than I am. That's why I asked that. You're a lot cooler and you're a lot more talented.
No.
So I'm like, did you like break the mold where they were like, he's so talented. Let's just celebrate him.
I mean, I did wind up, once I got into high school, I was kind of friends with everybody. You know, I was friends with the athletes and I was also in the marching band. So, you know, I kind of made peace with everyone. So
when did you transition from being the percussion guy to kind of go on, all right, I don't even really want to do that much anymore. Like, I want to play guitar.
Yeah. Well, my first band was born out of the marching band because the whole drum line, we were such good friends. And we all wanted to be in a band, but we were all drummers. And so it was, you know, one guy going, well, I have a guitar. And another guy saying, I have the drum kit. And I was like, well, I can find a bass. I'll borrow a bass. I borrowed a bass from somebody. So it was just we wanted to play music, but the only thing we knew how to play was drums. So we just kind of learned together and, you know, just by ear figuring out that. So then once I started figuring out things on the bass, and I had a piano that I would, you know, kind of mess around with, and a guitar that my uncle had given me, and my dad was like, "You're really good at figuring things out. You should pick up that guitar and try that." So then once I picked that up, didn't know how to play it. That's when I immediately started writing stuff so that I could play what I was writing.
Was music natural to you? Even though it was hard?
Yes, it was natural to me. It was
wild.
Very, yeah.
For you to be able to play A, E, G, C, E minor, you know, all the ones that you can.
Yeah.
Let me be honest, all the ones I play. For you to play.
It's all I play. Yeah.
Like, how quickly were you able to adapt and actually play, those main chords with your guys?
I mean, pretty quickly. You know, it didn't take very long before we were all writing songs together as a band. You know, they all sounded like Pearl Jam ripoffs, but, you know.
But didn't everyone?
But yeah,
it wasn't at all
at that point. Yeah.
Okay, so you go to school. You're going to do graphic art, illustration.
Yeah,
I'm messing that up. So
no, that's okay.
Yeah. You're also playing music. I would understand that 99 people out of 100 are going to make more money doing that graphic art job because they can probably get work.
Maybe. I think it depends on. Not necessarily in the field that I was headed towards. It was kind of equal to music, I think, because I wasn't interested in sitting at a computer and coming up with like graphic design. I'm more tactile and would rather get my hands in paint or sculpt or, you know, so and at that point I have a couple of friends that are classmates that are successful artists now. And it's been the same road. You know, it's just been grinding it out and keeping their head down and painting and painting and painting and painting until they finally, we all at the same age, they're having success as artists and I'm having success in music.
What was the first writer, we'll say break that you earned. What was your first break there where you go, okay, I'm not just now treading water. Like I might be able to have some real success at this.
Yeah. First sign of hope was a guy named Steve Holy. Recorded a song that Trevor and I wrote with our friend Matt Jenkins. And then really it was watching my friends have some success was really what gave you the real hope.
Is that because you knew that you could do what they do?
Well, I was doing what they were doing. I mean, we were doing it all together. So it was like Shane, for instance, he came in and played... I remember he played us the demo for Somewhere With You. And
Kenny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we were just like, damn, like that's different. That whatever that is the next step. And even though we weren't writers on it, we knew that was going to change the game for all of us. And even now when we watch Kenny play it, like we sit there and go, none of us would be here without that song. Because he wrote that, Kenny cut it. It changed Kenny's career. And because of that, me and Josh Osborne and Trevor Rosen and Matt Jenkins and Brandy Clark and, you know, we're all in that writer circle and we get to reap the benefits really of that exposure. So watching our each other succeed was really what kept us going. We were like, it's not like I'm doing it, but it's we're doing it, you know.
What about first success for you where a song actually got a single? Like a real life, it's got a chance single.
That was Wake Up Loving You by Craig Morgan. So that was the first one. I can't remember how high it went on the chart, if it was top 10 or not. But it was close, which was, you know, that's back then, that's all you want is like you want top 20. And then you get that and you're like,
do you watch
top 10.
Since it was your first, are you watching the charts every
back
week?
Back then, for sure. Yeah. Watching it all the time. I don't watch anymore, but.
When you hear that, at the beginning, the first time you hear it actually cut, are you like, I like what they did with that production?
My alarm clock, actually.
It really was?
Yeah. Yeah. I did. I did that on the demo. I made a little home demo of it with that alarm clock. There it is. And then. Everyone who cut it after that, a couple of artists cut it. Everyone used that alarm clock. Then it's just my alarm clock.
a couple cut it, but they didn't put it on a record.
I think Keith Anderson cut it. And I think it made a record for him, but it wasn't a single.
So then what's the rule there? Because Eric Paisley, who I'm buddies with, he wrote Friday Night, I think Friday Night song I'm thinking of, Lady A cut it, put it on the record.
Yeah, yeah.
He then said, well, he didn't use the single. I want to use the single. Went number one for him.
Right.
I want to be your Friday. Yeah. Is there a rule that if it doesn't go as a single, you can still probably cut it somewhere else?
Sure. Sure. I mean, once it, you know, once it is out, once somebody cuts it, anybody can cut it. So you can put it out as a single anytime.
Don't you have to ask for single rights, though?
No, only one. Oh, I don't think so. No. I mean, you do that one time. You give the license out one time. And once you approve it, it's fair game.
So you're telling me I could cut I Was on a Boat.
Yeah.
Put it out as a single.
Yeah.
And then once it beat you guys as the best streaming song.
Yeah.
That's just life.
Yeah, but we reap the benefits of that, so.
Yeah, but so do I.
Yeah, well, good for us all.
Well, looks like we all win that. Okay. Nice. First number one song that you wrote.
Say You Do for Dierks Bentley.
And was that a rocket ship number one? Or was that a, we don't know if he's going to cut it. He did cut it. We don't know if it's going to be on the record. We don't know.
All of them are like that, I feel like. That one was, you know, talking about breakthroughs and stuff. That, as far as writing that song, that was one that I was sure was something special.
Really? You knew when you wrote it?
Yeah. So,
was there any chance you were keeping these songs? Because Old Dominion was maybe...
We were a band at that point.
Were you signed?
No. So even like Wake Up Loving You was our like show closer, man. Like to let Craig Morgan have that song was a really tough decision. Because at that point, it started to feel like maybe we were so far away from getting signed, but it felt like maybe we were going to. So it was tough to kind of let that one go. Say You Do wasn't tough for us because we did play that song at every show. And, but at that point, man, you know, we're just trying to pay the bills and we moved here to be songwriters anyway. That's what we wanted. So it was awesome. And he did an incredible job. There was a moment where I was going to sing background vocals on it, but it didn't pan out. Man, it was just an exhilarating feeling to hear that song and watch that song climb to get your first number one. Amazing.
This chainsaw from the band Perry wrote this one.
Yeah.
Here's the one. Was it written as aggressive?
It's way more aggressive. Our version is way more aggressive. This one is the light version of it. So my dad actually made a comment one time about it. He was like, man, your version is like, you know, I can kind of picture you out in the woods like with like frozen snot in your beard cutting down the tree. It's definitely a lot more aggressive, our version.
Before we get over to the Old Dominion stuff, Ecstasy from Sam Hunt is probably, in my opinion, his biggest non-single song.
Yeah.
It wasn't a single, but everybody knows it.
Right. I wish that was a single.
To me, I kind of had to be reminded it wasn't a single.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I'm a big Sam guy. I like Sam away from work. You know,
yeah.
I love Sam
at
work. You know, so, but I love the song. When he cuts it, again, he cut it, though, if I'm not mistaken. This was on the pre.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, yeah.
And Sam wasn't Sam Hunt.
Right.
But did you, when you guys wrote it, was it written like, wow, this is different? Like, this is some like new territory type stuff?
I mean, we knew before everyone knew that it was, you know, Sam Hunt. Like, writing with that guy, you're like, damn, this guy is something entirely different.
Different so, in what means? Like,
just his creative mind is he attacks things at different angles. So the things that come out of his mouth, you're like, I don't know how you thought of that, but, you know, even like with Make You Miss Me, he throws out a line like, keep a Slipknot in the strings you attach. Like some obscure thought like that he can make seem very palatable. So just writing with him, that was a moment where you knew something was big was going to happen. So that song, it's funny, like he overthinks a lot of things. And to, you know, to his credit, it works, you know. But he, like most people, you sit in the room and you write, and at the end of the day, you got the song. you can write for weeks and weeks and weeks on the same song with Sam. So that's what happened. I never really knew the final version of Ecstasy until it came out. Like, I knew what I thought it was going to be.
Were there other little changes that you heard in it that you're like, well, I don't remember that at all?
Oh, yeah. That whole, like, talking part at the end, there's like a whole, like, kind of down bridge where he's kind of talking, saying, you look kind of cute and all this stuff. I didn't remember any of that stuff, but I mean, it's amazing.
Were you surprised to see the explosion
of him?
Yeah.
Nah. No. I mean,
I'm excited. I mean, I'm surprised to see any explosion of anybody, right?
Yeah.
Because it's always so unpredictable of who it's going to be, when it's going to be, and why it's going to be.
Yeah.
And with Sam, it hits so hard, so fast. And I feel like Sam is the most reluctant superstar that I've ever known.
For sure.
And when people are kind of bagging on him, I'm like, well, first of all, he's way smarter, way more talented than you. And he doesn't, listen, he loves to be an artist, but he didn't want to be the guy out.
Well, and people forget because everything now sounds like Sam Hunt. So it didn't then. Like,
right.
He changed it. And everything on country radio, half of it is just watered down Sam Hunt. So,
I agree. Kenny, save it for rainy day. Have this hook up here. When you write a song like this, how quickly do you send it to Kenny?
This one, you never, like, I didn't know Kenny at that point. And you never, ever write aiming at a certain artist. But this song has the, like, quickest journey ever, but a huge journey. But we used to write, Brad and I and our late friend Andrew Dorf used to write every morning at 9 in the, not every morning, every week at 9 in the morning. So we would have double booked ourselves. We would write from 9 to 11, and then we would go to our normal write. So that morning, I didn't have any ideas, but in the shower on the way or getting ready to go there, that kind of chorus popped into my head. So I showed up and I was like, hey, what about this? And they were like, yeah. And we wrote that song in 45 minutes. And at that time, Brad was making little home demos. And I kept kind of egging him on, like, dude, you got to make a demo. And I was joking. I was like, man, you want a Kenny Chesney cut or not? Like, make the demo. So he was like, okay, okay. And he made the demo. And sure enough, like, we got it right to him, and he picked it up. Like, it never happens like that, but that's the only time that's ever happened. And then he went and recorded it, and the studio musicians told us they only did one take of it. They played it and they moved on, so they thought, no way that's ever making it. So we wrote it in 45 minutes. They did one take of the recording session. And then it becomes a 3-week number one song. So pretty crazy.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you coming by. I know you're doing a lot. So to spend a little time here, we appreciate it. You guys can follow Old Dominion Music on Instagram or MT Ramsey. That's Matt's private account. All right. I guess not private, public, but solo account.
Yeah, yeah. Whichever one. Yeah.
Yeah. The private account. Only I have.
That's the other Matt Ramsey.
Yeah, that's it. All right. Thanks, Matt.
Yeah,
man.
So that was part one of the top 8 BobbyCast interviews of 2021. Come back next week to find out who makes the top 4. And you can go back and check out those full episodes on this same feed. Just scroll back through there and you'll see all the episodes from this year. And if you're looking for something else to listen to this holiday break, you can check out my podcast, Movie Mike's Movie Podcast. If you love movies, just need some recommendations, or you want to hear some interviews with actors and directors, I also do spoiler-free movie reviews, so you don't have to worry about anything getting ruined. Just search Movie Mike's Movie Podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. And my name is Mike D. You can follow me on Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, at Mike Destro. That's Mike, DeeEstro. And I'll talk to you next week on part 2.
This festival and concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop before attending your next concert. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink, shop new styles. If you can't make it to a store, just visit Tecovas.com. Tecovas.com. You can probably spell it. You probably know it. Tecovas.com. Find your new favorite pair of boots today. This is the year to stop overpaying for your family plan. So choose a Straight Talk Wireless family plan. Unlimited data, talk, and text on a reliable 5G network. And you can get a new line starting at $25 per line per month for 4 lines, plus taxes and fees and no contracts. That's good decision making. Available at Walmart and on straighttalk.com. Family plan discount with 4 lines, all on the Silver Unlimited plan. Not combinable with auto pay discount. In times of traffic, your data may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Video streams at up to 480p.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.